my first exposure to black tax. So I went to my dad. I said, "Dad, I want a BMX bike." And my dad bought me a flying pigeon. It was Chinese and it was orange.
There's a line that has been blurred, and you wonder, at what point did it turn from helping to dependency?
Take lessons from us. And that's why it's important to have a community wherever you go, because we've been here before you. We've made those mistakes for you. So take care of yourself first.
People that even try to build houses lost money, right? They get cheated by their family members and whatnot. So I think my mindset at this point in time is, for lack of a better word, every man for himself.
And people actually died. The lady, she was trying to build a motel back home, like a student housing. So she was working so much. And then this man also was building something back home. So they were always working all the time.
This is Assorted Immigrant Stories podcast. My name is Zenith Mwangahamambamalao, and I am your host. And for those of you that are stopping by for the very first time, this is a podcast about immigrant journeys, the things I and others wish we knew. We have interviews and share conversations with immigrants from diverse backgrounds and countries as they share their own immigration stories. We explore struggles, triumphs, and cultural adjustments. We discuss identity, belonging, and community. And we also highlight successes and contributions to both American society and back home. And that's wherever home might be. We also review some books that touch on the immigrant story. So don't forget to rate and review, like, share, and subscribe to wherever you get your podcast from. Welcome to another episode of Assorted Immigrant Stories podcast. And today in studio, I have a wonderful panel with me. And before I introduce the guests, I'll talk a little bit about what we're going to talk about today. In our last episode, we talked about financial literacy. So if you didn't listen to that, go back and listen. It's an episode with Mwaka. And it's financial literacy for immigrants, really, specifically life insurance. But to be honest with you, when it comes to money in the diaspora, so many of us are juggling so many things. People are skipping insurance and, you know, that kind of stuff. So, and there's this one thing that we are all silently, well, not maybe silently struggling with, but there's a thing that's hovering over us all the time and we're juggling with it. And it's a thing called black tax. Is it love? Is it obligation? Is it guilt? Is it financial trauma in disguise, or all of the above? So joining me in studio today, we have Dr. Henry Kasondem Soma. He is an educator, a writer, and a mentor. Say hello to our listeners and tell us where you're recording from.
Good evening. I am recording from Fort Worth, Texas. Good evening, everyone.
All right. And then we also have Mutsam Tengwa. She was on the show already, season one. I believe it's episode 7 or 6, and I might be telling a lie, but her episode is From Medicine to Entrepreneurial Journey. Mutsa, say hello to everyone and where you're recording from.
Hi. So, like she said, Mutsam Tengwa, I'm in Maryland in Harford County.
And finally, we have Priska Van De Vestas. She was a co-host on the Insaka Talk Show. And now the host of the new and wonderful Bridging Stories podcast. Welcome. Say hello to our listeners and tell us where you're recording from.
Hi, everyone. I am recording from Baltimore, Maryland.
That's wonderful. So I'm just going to go back in that order. I want you guys to tell me, what does the term black tax mean to you? Priska, you can lead us with that.
Well, I had to be the first one. I think for me, it's like an unspoken contract for not really success, like where if you are up there or if you left the country, you're here, you have to take care of your siblings back home or everybody else that's left back home.
Okay. Mutsa, what's your take on black tax, the term? What does it mean to you?
It's like paying your dues. You know, I put you through school, so now in return, you do something for me. Yeah, it feels like Jews, like something like you're obligated to do just because somebody did something for you when you're younger.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what do you think of the term itself? Like black tax, is that like a good name?
When we add tax to it, like saying black tax, the word tax itself makes it feel like a burden. You know how we here in America, we feel about taxes and everything. Yeah, so it makes it feel like a burden. I don't feel like saying black tax would be like the appropriate word for it.
Yeah. Okay. Dr. Mustafa, what's your take on black tax? What do you think? What are your thoughts about it?
The first time I heard the word was actually in South Africa from my friends. I hadn't heard about it until then, you know. And like Mutsa said, when we call it tax, it comes with a connotation. You know, like I think when you ask the question, is it love, guilt, and obligation? I think it's more nuanced than that. I think at the core of everything, it's what differentiates us from our Western friends, you know. I think it gives us a sense of purpose,
right?
You know, so while it might feel like an obligation, I'll give you an example. Like for my parents, I never felt obligated. My parents had never needed money from me,
right,
to live, you know, like they never ever did. But I still sent money home, you know. So there's something to me that's a little bit more nuanced than how it's usually presented, but I do understand when people say it's like an obligation.
Okay.
You know?
Okay, yeah. So very interesting takes there. I also don't particularly like the term black tax. Black tax has sort of a negative connotation to it, just like Dr. Musoma alluded to. Look, there's a way in which I imagine that I'd be helping my parents today. You know, I did lose my parents when I was really young, and I guess naturally, there are just certain aspects of your life you just get to appreciate just much later in your life. And unfortunately for me, I don't have them. And there's a way in which I think about them. I do not walk into Home Goods or HomeSense without thinking about my mom, for example. Or even Costco, you know, things like that. Just brings back warm feelings. And I cannot see, you know, like golf clubs or without thinking, oh, maybe I could have been buying that for my dad. Or working in healthcare, like, how would I be doing that? I worked here as a GNA, geriatric nursing assistant, taking care of older people, and my parents would be older now. And I imagine how I would participate in that, which is why I don't quite like the term, because it's just like negative. And yes, there are some beautiful things about giving back. Mutsa, I'll start with you in your statement that someone did something for you and you're giving back. So even as a child, when did it come to you? Like, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do.
Child, I never saw it that way. I in my family, we had two people who were in the UK. It was an uncle who left, went to medical school in the UK, but he never actually like paid lobola to my sister, but he left my cousin's sister with a son. So maybe he felt guilty, and we used to live with my cousin and the son. So he always sent money monthly, and it became something like we looked forward to. Then when I was growing up and I was in primary school and high school, did I think it was, you know, like black text? I just felt like, oh, his wife and child are here, so he's supposed to send something back home. And then my aunt, who was in the UK, she had left, flew out to the UK from Harare. But then when she was doing all her visa processes and everything, she stayed at our house, and my mom helped her with all the legwork. So I felt like, oh, it's only right for you to kind of help my mom here and there with something, because, you know, the embassy was in Harare. My mom was helping because she was coming from a smaller remote place in Zimbabwe. So growing up, when I was a little kid, did I think, okay, it's black, like how we look at it now? No. But then when it hit me was the first time Priska asked me, like, when was the last time you're in Zimbabwe? I said 14 years. When I was in med school, I went home, and med school was very financially challenging for me. And then when I went home, I'm still a student. As soon as I got there, everyone was looking at me like, what did you bring for us? At that moment, the term wasn't black text, but I was shocked, like, I'm in med school. I'm actually a student. Why are you expecting me to come home with something? Then it hit me. The moment you leave Zimbabwe to go anywhere else and then you come back home, or if you're there, wherever you are, you're in school doing whatever, people just expect you to send something home because you are the one who's outside. You've made it to leave the country. You're just supposed to send something home. And when you come back home, you're supposed to bring little gifts for everybody. That's when it became apparent to me. Probably I was 22. Mm-hmm. And then I never went home after that.
Traumatized.
I was.
Are you running?
I'm running. I hope they don't ever listen to this. Yeah, I was traumatized, honestly. I was traumatized because people were even in their feelings, moody. And where I was staying, like Zenith, my parents passed away when I was younger. My dad died when I was 9. My mom died when I was 14. So when I go home, I'm going to my aunt's place. You know, when you're even squeezing the toothpaste in the house, you're like, hey, let me even just do a quarter because I didn't come with anything. And people are looking at you like, you're coming from the diaspora, huh? And just squeezing toothpaste, like, you know, stuff like that. So I never went home. I was traumatized. I was like, this is it.
Yeah, that's an interesting take. All right, Prisca.
For me, when I was younger, I guess, like she said, I didn't know that it was black tax, but I know for sure that my aunt, my mother's older sister, she was like very well to do. She was married to a Scottish man and she always just took care of everybody. She wanted to educate everybody. She wanted to send you to school outside the country just to make sure that everybody was okay. For my grandmother to my mother was married, for my grandmother to her siblings, my mom's kids and stuff like that. So she's even the one that started the trend of once you're in grade 7, you leave the country, you go to school outside. So some of my family members went to UK and some of us went to South Africa. But it hit me, like she said, I went back home to Africa after 21 years. Zambia and South Africa. No, 21 years South Africa, 23 years Zambia. 23 years Zambia. And, oh my God, I was traumatized, like she said. It was just, I literally felt like I was having a nervous breakdown. I had to leave Zambia and go to South Africa for some time. But then I also understood that I can help a little bit more with just the way people were living and how things were happening. So coming back 3 years ago, it was just like, okay, let me help out. But then do you get exhausted? And when you say no, because you've started the trend of, okay, I'm going to help out here and there, do you say no? Do you not say no? So 3 years ago, that's when it really hit me to say, all right, this is black tax.
Okay. All right. So Dr. Musoma, did you grow up expecting, you know, to send money when you grow up, or is, you know, did it just hit you as an adult and you're like, wait, what? Like, where did those lessons come from?
So, you know, as everybody was speaking, I just had a memory. My memory is from my childhood, my first exposure to black tax. Mm-hmm. I wanted a BMX bicycle. Remember how the white kids had BMX bicycles? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I went to my dad. I said, Dad, I want a BMX bike. And my dad bought me a flying pigeon. It was Chinese and it was orange. And it even had tassels, you know, like the little tassels on the handlebars. Yes. And and I remember thinking, I think so for me, this is my first exposure to black tax. At this point, I remember going to Dad and saying, how could you buy me this bike when I really wanted a BMX? And my dad said, no, we send money to the village. We support these different people, you know, so the best that I could give you now is this bike, you know, and he explained it. And I think for me, that's when the seeds are being sown of thinking, oh, I have to do something to pull up other people behind me, you know, I hated it. I hated it. In fact, after that, I started hating reading Peter and Jane and all those books that we used to read back home. Because Peter and Jane, they had a nice, beautiful golden retriever or in the park, and it was only mom and dad. And at our house, it would be like 10 people, you know, plus extended family. So I think for me, that's when I start to be exposed to this idea of giving back, you know. Then moving to the States, I think also black tax, maybe we also have to, it has to be discussed in terms of socioeconomics. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's, depending on where you're coming from, there's expectations that are different, right? I think my dad, because of the space he took, broke that a little bit for me. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It wasn't as harsh as it could have been, because people were still going to my dad, not to me. You know, so I think I'm a little bit privileged in this conversation in that regard, you know.
Right.
And but now that dad is gone, I get calls. I get a lot of calls. Mm-hmm. So you're not immune, even if you're from, you know, different socioeconomic strata. Everybody's impacted.
Yeah. So I really resonate with what you just said, because for me as well, my dad died when I was 19. When did I start to understand this? Great. Well, I lived in it, but maybe only understood it later as an adult. So obviously growing up in the household, you had extended family members all the time, cousins, aunties, uncles who lived with us and were going to school. So I recognized real early that my parents were helping their family members. But when I dug deeper, I found that my parents were helped too. So for instance, my aunt, my dad at some point in his life had stayed with his uncle at some point in his childhood. One day I will share the full story. I have both of my parents' stories recorded, you know, but those are stories for another day. And my mom, it was the same thing. She had a cousin who lived in Luang Sharon. She was married to a policeman at the time. My mom had finished 10th grade, and in those days, it was like a big deal. She called her, hey, come and help me take care of my babies, and I'll pay for your night school. So it worked that way. So I always understood that you look back, you help someone, and hopefully that person becomes self-sufficient, and then they can in turn help somebody else. Except as I've grown older, somehow I see that there's a line that has been blurred where somehow that help is continued and it doesn't stop. And you wonder, at what point did it turn from helping to dependency? So there's that. And sometimes you realize it's perhaps a lack of boundaries, or like you think of what the outcome should be, but you don't share that. Right. So because what you think someone needs is not what they think they need. That's not the vision that they have. Right. But for me, I'm like, oh, I need to pick 3-4 girls, you know, maybe 2 from my dad's side, 2 from my mom's side, send them to school. And, you know, maybe when they graduate, then they can pay it forward. At least that's how I thought it would work out. So I made that decision on my own because I thought that's what I was supposed to do. Actually, it's what I'm supposed to do, but it wasn't the right time. Let me put it that way, because I was still an international student. I was skipping paying health insurance, you know, and all the important things that I needed, because I'm thinking I need to eat. I need to pay my rent. You know, I need to pay my international school fees that are crazy high, but I also need to pay those 4 school fees back home. And I did that until some had dropped out. I didn't even know. Okay, maybe a couple got to grade 12, you know, and you don't even, because nobody tells you, oh, so-and-so stopped going to school and you're just sending the money. So, yes. But when I also went home in 2013, it really was overwhelming, because I spent a lot of money. I mean, my friends, Mutsa, they joke. They say that was a $15,000 trip. I mean, I went with drums, clothes, which were probably outdated. And I even took a BlackBerry that was apparently outdated. And you come back and you question, you're like, why did I do that? Like, why did I do that? So which comes to the question of boundaries, which I'm going to ask you guys. So I think to give, like you said, it differentiates us from other cultures, and it's good. And, you know, if your cup is full, you can do it. But how do you then enforce? Do you guys have boundaries? Do you have good boundaries around this? Where does it stop? Like, where do you say, okay, yes, this, but now this is too much? Because someone will ask you for 8,000 kwacha, but they really just need 500. Like, what causes that? So, Mutsa, tell me your thoughts.
I have cases, right? I'm going to start with my cousin. This is really recent. It happened on Thursday last week. One of my cousin brothers, you know, at home, they are no cousins. It's your brother, right? Mm-hmm. So my brother, He is like a, what you call it, matatu driver, like a taxi, combi driver. What you call it in Zambia?
A taxi driver,
like the one, the omnibus.
Yeah, a minibus.
So he was really struggling sending his kids to school. He has two boys. And I told him, don't worry. I'm going to send your kids to school. What you have to do is come up with money for rent, feeding, and utilities, right? The kids, every term, I will send the kids to school. I've been doing it for 2 years. On Thursday, I heard that he has a second wife who just gave birth to twins. I told him next semester, I'm not paying anything for those two boys. You're done. Because the moment as African men at home have extra 2 cents, just 2 cents, they think they can go get another smallie, another chips funga somewhere, just because it's extra 2 cents. I was like, now you're too comfortable. I'm not doing it. That was last week. So with me, in terms of boundaries, right, I will help. But let me hear something about you being, I don't know, not appreciating the help you're getting, or you're actually out there living according to the means that I think you have. Then I become pissed off. I'm not pissed off. I get pissed off. Honestly, I do get pissed off because I don't have a tree that I'm shaking here and then dollar bills fall, you know, and then I just send the money back home. And then that's case number one. Case number two, this one is a very tricky case because after my mom died, I was taken by my aunt and uncle, right? And I mean, even while my mom was still alive, my mom was sick for a very lengthy period of time before she finally passed. So my uncle and aunt, they really helped with hospital bills, making sure that the three of me and my siblings stayed in school. So I have a soft spot for her. I pray she never listens to this. I have a soft spot for her. Right. I really soft spot for her because at home it's hard to say you don't even have enough. And then from not having enough, you break to pay tuition for other people and send someone to the hospital frequently. So she now has a farm, a very big farm. 3 months ago, she asked me for 35,000 to start. She wanted to have like, what you call it? Chickens that lay eggs, but she wanted to buy, like, start in the hundreds of thousands. She wanted to start big, right?
Is this $35,000?
$35,000. Yes.
Oh, that's tax. Now that's tax.
I thought you were going to say Zimbabwean money.
No, US dollars, $35,000. So now I'm married to an American man. Before I even come to him with saying, can I send $250 at home? I have to like revise everything in front of a mirror. Like if he says, then I say, if he says, then I say, you know, for him to understand, because his questions are like, but this person is employed, you know, why can't they, but you have to make him see the whole picture, you know? So I'm thinking she wants 35. How, I normally struggle with just 250. How would I even say mama needs 35,000? You know, I ended up, we went back and forth, my husband, back and forth. I ended up sending 10,000. When I sent that 10,000, it was as if I sent $10. There was no thank you. After sending the 10,000, she only called me 3 days later to say, we are not going to use that money because it's not up to, so we cannot even start the project. Then I said to them, so it's like I sent money through someone who also like sends money. I don't know. She's like a middle person. The person can send the money back to me in America immediately. So I said, don't worry. Just give the person the money so that they can send the money back to me if it's not enough. There was a lot of tension. We went for weeks without talking just because I didn't send enough. I didn't send 35,000. But here even, so I even felt like in that moment, I should have just set a boundary. Like, auntie, if you want to do like chickens and you don't have enough, start with 25. Start from where you can. How much do you need to start with 50 or 25 chickens? You don't have to start with 250,000, you know? So there I didn't set my boundaries. And sometimes I feel like with all my relatives at home, my auntie, she has a soft spot. And it's hard for me to set boundaries because I know she went above and beyond for my family and me. But the other ones, I'm the judge, I'm the executioner, I'm the, if you mess up, I cut. I cut immediately. But then I have this one relative that I really struggle to set boundaries with because I know they also sacrificed a lot. So it's hard, you know.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. That's difficult. That's difficult. All right. Dr. Soma, do you have anything to share with that?
The issue of boundaries is so important with what Mutsa said because, you know, this conversation is dynamic because we didn't, you know, in terms, it's organic, right? So right. I shouldn't be held to what I said at the beginning. I don't think it's fair because as you hear other people, then you start to get different insights on this issue, right? Mm-hmm. And so listening to the story you shared about sending the 10,000, it's almost like there's a value and a worth that comes back to giving. It's almost like it feeds an ego. It's like white people when they go on mission trips, you know? Have you seen that, like in church? Not all of them are spiritual, by the way. Everybody's just like feeding egos for the most part. You know, oh my gosh, did you see what we did? I think we have that same complex. Right. So you might as well call us black saviors. You know, when they talk about a white savior mentality, there's also something you and I can call a black savior mentality where nobody has really asked you. It makes sense.
Yeah.
Nobody told you to come with stuff to give to people, you know, but then you just have this sense of taking a lot of stuff back home, you know, but you're the one who's stressed. Nobody's ever really asked. Mm-hmm. You know, like I used to buy my dad a lot of shirts, blah, 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 perfume, whatever, you know, but they didn't ask, you know. And so one day my mom sat me down. There was a funeral and I sent money to this funeral. And my mom said, you've got four children. You know, how are you building your savings? You know, if you keep sending these types of sums of money to people, what's happening to your core? You know, and in that moment, my mom was actually a scolding. Wasn't even a conversation. My mom said, stop, you know, people, they've got their own children. You've got your children, you know? And so boundaries is something, by the way, I want to recommend a book by Dr. Henry Cloud. If you've not read it, the title is Boundaries. It's been an important thing for me. And let me even push it further. Musa, so I came here first in my family. Then my siblings came, you know? I wanted to do things for my siblings that sometimes were not asked of me because it felt like, you know what, then I earned my name. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. In Zambia, they'll say, Nibadia, you know, Nibadia, you know what I mean? That's the guy with a nice heart. And, you know, we love to hear that stuff if we're not careful, instead of us. So for me, I think a lot of it came from maybe not even the most purest of spaces. It's not like just generosity, but also a need for place and position in our families back home. Because, you know, in Africa, that's important, right? Like, you know, like when you go to a funeral, you know those uncles everybody ignores because they don't do anything in the family? Like, they don't even make any decision at the funeral. People just like, don't even speak, you know? Like, I don't want to be that guy, you know? So, let's not call it black tax. I call it membership. I'm going to be a member in the circle of people that can be respected. You know?
Yeah.
You got that right?
It's membership.
Absolutely.
Okay. That is true.
So, Dr. Musoma, don't forget to text us that book so that we can add it in the show notes. Okay.
Okay. Priscilla, no problem.
Let's go. Tell us, you know, what, you know, there's any stories that you can share and how you enforce boundaries, if you have any.
I also have a person in my life that I have a very soft spot for. But when is enough enough? When do I, you helped me, you took care of me, let's say 3-4 years. I've been doing it for a very long time. And for me, it's like, what happened to paying it forward? If you can take care of me, doesn't mean that I have to do the same for you. Let me also do something for somebody else that really needs it. You really don't need it. You're just asking because you want, right? And then when it comes to Sadiq, I also have a cousin who I need a passport. I will send money. Oh, no, I use that money for something else. And eventually when I went, I had sent money like 3 times for her to get a passport. And eventually when I went, I was just like, enough is enough. I'm not doing this anymore. I decided to pay for a passport. She got a passport, but there was always a story. And the last straw for me was this time when I went, I saw my brother the first day. The second day, he went drinking. So I realized that these people that are asking for money are not really hungry. They're not going to die. They don't work overtime like we do. They don't stress like we do. So I was like, I cannot pour from an empty bucket. Like if my cup is not full, I'm going to make sure that my cup is full, take care of myself. And then the overflow is what I can share and give you. So I also learned saying no doesn't mean that I love you less. It's just because I cannot give you what I don't have. Right. Those are the boundaries that I've set. And just having a conversation from the beginning to say, I don't have it now. I don't know when I'm going to have it. When I have it, then I can help.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You know, and for me, I think I resonate with everything everybody said. And Prisca and Mutsa, I think I have something similar. I have an aunt I have a very soft spot for because she's my mom's sister. So obviously when my mom died, she's the only one in the family who sort of always looked back, like how are my sister's children from, you know, from as far as I can remember. Everyone else, right. Like, and so maybe they were young, you know, everybody was just focused, you know, on their families. It's only now as an adult. So now sometimes there's this tension, like, oh, she's the one who gets the money. What about the rest of us? You know, and it can be very, very, very toxic. And sometimes I always question myself. I'm like, okay, so, but the exaggeration of how much, well, I don't know if it's an exaggeration or if what somebody actually wants. I don't know where it comes from, but I'm going to share a story with you guys.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we're kids, we used to have this thing like pen pals, right? Like in school, inter schools, you know, when we went to the trust schools, we used to have these like inter school games and then finals. So during those times, you could get pen pals and you wrote letters to each other and that kind of stuff. So, and then sometimes for us, we had a lot of teachers who came from the UK. They'll hook us up with like their nieces, nephews, and what have you. So my fifth grade teacher said, oh, he used to call me talking machine. He was like, oh, I have a niece. You can be pen pals. And and I'll never forget her name, Naomi McKee. So I was in grade 5. I got the contact. And, you know, for us, I think I wrote the letter first. I'm not giving my parents to read the letter. So they have no idea what I'm writing in there. You know, I'm in grade 5.
Yeah.
So I wrote the letter, sent it to her. She responded with a few gifts from the UK, and it was like some pencils and something. And I remember there was like even stains of coffee. She was like, oh, yeah, sorry, there's stains of coffee because my dad was reading the letter. I was like, oh, wow. Her parents are even proofreading the letter. And then I replied. But when I replied, I was asking for money. I was in grade 5. I don't know. Maybe I needed the money for Compass. But can you imagine? And I think I don't know how much pounds I asked for. But guess what? That was it. That was the end of that pen portion. she never wrote back. Goodness. I never heard from her. Even in my adult age, I've tried to look for her. Like, I would put Naomi McKee, but so many of them come up. So I always wonder, like, where did that come from? And the reason I say that is I meet people, and they're, oh, yeah, we're cousins. You connect. And by the third conversation, they're telling you this big number. And I'm thinking, do you even know how hard it is to get that number? But on the other side, you have this thing, like Dr. Msuma was saying, you want to belong, right? Like, I want to belong. I want to have cousins and aunties and uncles. But sometimes it can make for challenging relationships when that sort of exists. And if you don't give, it strains the relationships. Suddenly you're not talking. So, you know, just an interesting thing there. And as far as boundaries, for me, I know I made a lot of mistakes. Like I said, when I first came, I put it on me. No one asked me, you know, like Dr. Msuma said, like, I put it on me. I thought I was supposed to do that. Now imagine, I'm skipping on health insurance, you know, because I'm skipping on so many things that today we are telling people, please don't skip on health insurance. Don't skip on life insurance. Don't skip on, you know, group life insurance. For example, in our community, we have like what? 300 and something people in the community. We have 3% of people signing up. And I'm always thinking about that young person who sort of just came. They maybe don't have that kind of a job where they can have like a big life insurance. So maybe they can't qualify for the other types of life insurance. And what you need is this group life insurance. But you have your, I don't know, your mother, sister, your father, sister, your mother, father hovering over you. And you need to send them this $50. So that will lead me to the next question. What would you advise a 22-year-old person that, you know, or a young person who's coming to the United States and, you know, they're so stressed out about, they need to pay for rent, they need to eat, pay for school, but they also need to send money to their sister's children who need to go to school. How would you advise them? How should they go about it?
I would say take lessons from us. And that's why it's important to have a community wherever you go, because we've been here before you. We've made those mistakes for you. So take care of yourself first. They're not going to die. They will leave. They will survive. They're probably even doing much better than you're doing, because back home, you are not paying bills as much as you will be paying here. I recently came across a story. Well, this guy who's is a social media person. I don't remember his name. And he was talking about, I'm done. Enough is enough. I'm no longer going to send money home. He was friends with this girl who almost died from exhaustion, because she was working two jobs and she was looking for a third job. When he asked her why she was looking for a job, she said, my sister's getting married in Nigeria and I want to give her the best wedding that I can give her. But in the meantime, she had a ton of notice for her electricity. She didn't pay her cell phone bill. So he was asking her, why are you doing this? Why don't you just take care of yourself? So enough is enough. Like, let's take a lesson from that. So take care of yourself before you take care of everybody else. That would be my advice.
Yeah. Dr. Msoma?
I would say, you know, there's a quote by T.S. Eliot where he says, we shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and to know the place for the first time. You know, I think there's something deeply attached to the way we do what we do. I'd be very careful at giving advice. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I've heard somebody say, don't take away from your children what made you a man. Mm-hmm. You know? So if the struggle, if the giving back to our people was our juice, would we have attained to the level we have if we didn't have that juice? You know what I'm saying? Because I see some of my peers here in the U.S. that are aimless, you know, like they have artificial problems. You know what I mean? Like they have to buy new horse riding equipment. And blah, blah, blah. They're always looking for something. Go climb rocks. You know, like, I wonder whether, as much as it's, quote unquote, somewhat burdensome, I wonder how much of our humanity we owe it. You know, like Kenneth Kaunda said, when the West is done with taking our resources, the final export out of our continent will be our humanity. And so I would be very careful to say, take care of yourself. I would say find what works for you, but because you not even balance, because balance is unfair. Because you know what? I think about this. If my uncle, my father's brother, didn't shine shoes when their father died and helped my dad go to school, my story wouldn't exist.
But was he killing himself to do that, or was he able to do that?
Not
able. I guess for me that's where I struggle is if I cannot pay my phone bill, I use my phone to work, then I'm going to work extra hard to take care of your problem. I guess maybe that's for me, that's where I struggle.
I see. Okay, no.
You know what I'm saying? Like, give when you have extra. When you can give, like, you cannot pour from an empty cup. If I don't have, I can't pay my bills. Let me pay my bills first so I can leave and then I can leave and work and be healthy and be normal to give extra now to you, to give you help. But I'm not going to kill myself for you, which means I'm just working for you. I guess that's where I was coming from. Okay. When I said take care of yourself. Yeah.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
All right, Kola, thank you for joining us. Kola, thank you for joining us. We're just beginning to wind down, but I'm so happy that you're here. I would love to hear the Nigerian perspective. We're talking about Black Tax, and I had asked a question about what would you tell a 22-year-old coming now? How would you advise them? How should they go around black tax? So before we get to you, Kola, Mutsa, answer that question, then we'll let Kola introduce himself.
If I was advising somebody, I would say, like, my friend, face your front. There are stages to these things. Face your front. Face your problems. Because there was a time when I came into this country, I remember this is going to be a little bit TMI, but we're all grown. I walked into Walmart, right? It was that time of the month for me. And then I saw a pack of pads was $6.81. It was unbelievable to me that so till menopause comes, I'm going to spend almost $10 every month because you actually probably need two. So that's $20. Where I was coming from in Europe, you probably needed like €1. Back home, it's not even as much, right? So if I was at a stage where even sanitary pads were expensive and they were only $6, even if you call me and you say, I need $25, I wasn't at a stage where I could do it. Zenith can probably remember. I went for probably the very first year when I came to America when people say, I'm going to make my hair. To me, that sounded foreign. I used to do, I don't know what you call it in Zambia, where you take a string and then you do, we call it mabanzi in Zimbabwe. Like you just use string and then you do like little, you join the strings together. I don't know. So I used to make my own hair because I couldn't even afford to go to like a braiding store that there was levels to. So there are levels to these things. And guess what? When you finally overcome that threshold where at some point you now even have like 150 left at the end of the month and you can do all these other things without really looking at the price tag in the store, now you can pick up the phone and say, this month I have $30. Can it pay the water bill? Can it pay electricity bill? The time to send money for everyone who comes from Africa, it's coming. Don't rush it. Just for the first few years, just do you, because it's a lot. And, you know, the problems we face individually coming into the country are different. I came into this country, I had no relative. So maybe somebody comes, they have probably a cousin. So maybe when I'm saying I walked into Walmart and sanitary pads were $6.81, a relative was providing that for them. For me, I had to like find the money for myself to do that. So I feel like there are levels to these things. I'll just tell the person, like, don't rush it. 2-3 years time, the same phone calls now or even multiply, you'll be able to send. So for now, just face your front. Face your front.
Can I push back a little bit on Mutsa? Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. That's what we say. But this country, with every new level for most people, it's a Range Rover, it's this. That makes sense. It's a Mercedes, it's an Audi, it's a bigger house. So I always tell my students, if you're stupid poor, you're going to be stupid rich. If you're generous poor, you're going to be generous rich. So I would not delay generosity for a time when things are right. Because in this country, you and I know, we're in perpetual, what's the word?
I get it. I get what you're saying.
You know?
That don't end.
Yeah, like you're going to move into a bigger house. So now you're going to tell them, oh, I'm paying $5,000 for a home, so I can't give you anything. So I feel like practice generosity from the moment you enter, but let it be commensurate with where you are.
But do you hear me, though?
I hear you. I hear you. Because guess what? Even a person in the U.S. who's working as a waiter or in Walmart, you see all these people from all over, or even in restaurants washing dishes. We're still wealthier than some of our relatives who are eating one meal a day.
Dr. Msoma, for me, honestly, the first day in this country, I was on my knees. I
have
no words to even describe how I struggled. You know, it was hard. It was really hard. It was really, really hard. And I get what you're saying. There are people in this country whereby with every $20 increase at work or $10 or 3% increase, you want more, you want to match, you're going to go to the bank and get whatever, bigger mortgage, bigger, a nicer car. But I'm one of those, probably not everybody. The car that I bought, I came into this country 2016. The car I bought in 2017 is still the same car that I drive.
Oh, you need to change your car, man.
It's a very nice, reliable Camry.
Musa, did you see that ad on Facebook that said, if you're still driving a 1993 Camry, Toyota just put out a note to say, please buy a new one. This car will not die.
Toyotas are so reliable, and I wish I knew that lesson before I gave up my Toyota Corolla. But let's not, that's topic. That's lifestyle creep. That's
a whole thing for another
day. Kola, I want to get a chance to Kola to introduce yourself. Tell us where you're recording from. And we're talking about black tax. I want you to briefly tell us, what does the term black tax mean to you? Is it a good name? Could there be a better name? And when did you first learn about black tax? And what would you advise somebody young coming to this country? Take the floor.
So that is a lot of questions all wrapped into one. And I am going to miss a few. So I don't know that. I'm going to try. And you can let me know which one I miss. And we can go from there. Mm-hmm. So my name is Kola. I do other things, but primarily in this forum, I'm one of the co-hosts of the Better Informed Immigrant podcast, as well as the Africa Hired podcast. So a lot of what I do in the podcasting world, hopefully in the media, is kind of focused on either Africa or bridging the gap between Africans in Africa and Africans in the diaspora. So that's kind of what the things that I do in that space. So I don't know that I would say that black tax is the right word for it, because I think the reality of the situation is we have to understand that I think it gives the wrong image, right? Because, you know, black is not one thing. It's not just folks that came from the continent or folks on the continent. So when we talk about black tax, it means different things to different people. So I'm not sure what the right term should be, but I wouldn't necessarily use that term. How did I come to know about that? I think, you know, my experience, I grew up in Nigeria, actually was born in the U.S., grew up in Nigeria, and then came back to the U.S. So, you know, in our culture, you always had this, you were always taught this concept that you are not an island, right? You are part of a community, and who you are is irrelevant, is what the community is that is actually more important. So, for example, you know, when they ask you, who are you, what they really want to know is, what's your family name, right? And based on that, you know, if somebody does well in your family, that speaks for you either positively or negatively in the community at large. Now, with that said, specifically about this topic that we're talking about, you know, I my mindset has changed over the past past few years, right? I'm of the mindset that if I saw somebody coming into the country, I'm going to tell. And this happens a lot, especially with Nigerians. I'm not sure if it's for other Africans as well. People come here, they maintain their ties to their family members or friends back on the continent for a period of time. And then it gets to a point where they just basically cut off all of those ties. And the reason why they cut off those ties, I think, is because of a few different reasons. In some cases, the friends and family back home take advantage of these folks, right? And what I mean by that is, for example, somebody comes over here, a very common story is they come over here, some of them go into entrepreneurship. At the time when I was growing up, the thing was cars, so they would buy used cars and send it back to the country, right? And then say, hey, why don't you sell this car? Send me my money back, and then we would just rinse and repeat. And what would happen is that all of them that I know that did that business all lost. And what would happen is that these folks back home would tell you one story and another, or, oh, yeah, they said it doesn't work. They said this, they said that. At the end of the day, the car is gone. The money is gone. And for some of these people, what they did actually was they used credit cards to buy this car with the hope that they would make a return on it, be able to pay the credit card back and whatnot, right? So that's kind of what leads people to say, hey, you know what? I'm going to cut ties with the people back home. And it's more common than not. So to the question about, you know, what would I tell somebody that just came to the country? I do think there's value in saying, hey, you need to be financially literate, which is what Dr. Musuma was saying earlier. And I agree completely with that. You need to be financially literate. You also need to watch out for lifestyle creep and whatnot. And I do understand the concept about the fact that there are some people, not everybody, but there are some people back home who are in very difficult situations. And in that case, maybe it makes sense to do more things. But there are a lot of people back home who are not in those difficult situations. And in my opinion, where I am today is I just quite frankly taken advantage, right? Yes, we understand that there are limits. There are some limitations in opportunity in Africa. Africa, that's not the right way to say it. In some countries in Africa, possibly all of Africa, there are some limitations in opportunities. When I say that, I think things like employment opportunities and whatnot. For some people, that's true. But for a lot of people, that is not true. I have cousins, for example, that graduated from college. They don't work. They don't have any professional job, right? Yes, it is true that finding a job in Nigeria is difficult. Unemployment is a real issue. But other people are doing it. And some of these people are not even taking the steps to do it. And what do I mean by taking the steps to do it? I mean, leave the hometown where there are no jobs, go to the city and see whether or not you can get a job. When you finally give them something, right, they don't manage that thing in a profitable way, right, in a meaningful way, right? I've never met, you guys could let me know if your experience is different, but I have never met somebody who's told me, hey, I sent money back home and we were able to do something productive with it. All the people that I know that say I did a business, I tried to do it with my family members or friends, they all went south. It wasn't profitable. They lost money. The people that even tried to build houses lost money, right? They get cheated by their family members and whatnot. So I think my mindset at this point in time is, for lack of a better word, every man for himself. Because the reality of the situation is that these folks, they're not bad people, please understand, right? But they don't see the struggle that you're going through, right? In Nigeria, if I'm not working, I can always go to my sister's house, my brother's house. I will always be welcome with open hand. We'll all share the meal and whatnot. Over here, if you're not working, you're on the streets. Nobody's going to take care of you, right? And like you were saying earlier, you don't have any family members yet, right? So when you finally do give and the person mismanages the stuff, it's not really pleasant to kind of see. And they don't have an understanding of the challenges that you face, right? They think that you're in luxury when they don't really understand this stuff, right? I've never spoken to, my dad comes and goes all the time, and I was speaking to him last time. He has no concept about the challenges of what we face here when it comes to money, right? So I am rambling and going on and on. I think to kind of shorten my answer to that 22-year-old or whatnot is, I'm sorry you are here. Hopefully you are going to get to a point where you can be a blessing to others. But quite frankly, you need to focus on yourself. Otherwise, you're going to die and nobody's going to care. They would move on.
But, you know, let me say something. It might seem like an over-exaggeration, what he just said, that you might die. Actually, people do die. Uh-huh. So in my first 2-3 years, I worked in assisted living. And twice, first time I actually saw a person who died, there's this lady, she was a shift champion. You want to take a day off, you ask her. Anyone wants to do, yeah, you just call her. Everyone just knew, you want to do something, just call her. And then one day, you know, when you're doing the change in the morning, she literally died on a sofa in the home that she was working. And I came behind another Nigerian lady. So at first we just felt like, oh, she worked so much, so she was tired. We got into the house. We didn't wake her up. It was much later, probably an hour plus later. I'm like, she can't hear us. You know, it's time for her to go home. We shake her. That's when we notice, oh, she died. Autopsy, she had a blood clot, blah, blah, blah. She died. And another gentleman who actually died in his car, leaving work after working 3 shifts consecutive, like first shift, second shift, third shift. I don't know what happened, but he got into his car. He tried, I think he had a stroke immediately, and then he just died. But those people are like shift champions, you know? Yeah. And people actually die. And all they're doing, they're dying. The lady, she was trying to build a motel back home, like a student housing. So she was working so much. And then this man also was building something back home. So they were always working, all the time, always working. And these are people that I actually know who died from, actually, I feel like, from overworking. And it's actually a real thing.
Yeah. So I think, Dr. Musoma, you might be alone on this one, because I think for me as well, a 22-year-old that comes based on my experience and what I went through, I would say, and I get what you're saying, because I did that, like trying to share that last $50 and it's the only one I got. But like I said, I'm skipping on health insurance, I'm skipping on life insurance, and like you're all pointing out, people are dying. We have young people dying. And then now you're not in some group life insurance. Now we have to do a GoFundMe. Your family is at home. You're the only one here. You're 21 years old. We have to send this body. And it's sad to see, because that happened. I remember, I'll never forget some young man from, is it Tennessee or Alabama, who died last year. We had a number of them die at the same time. But this young boy, he was the only one here. And so I would also say something very similar. And that would be like, you know what? Settle down. Take care of yourself. Explain to the people back home. They will be okay. They will be okay. Because sometimes I used to look at people and think, oh my God, look at how they are living. But no, they're fine. They eat their meals. Even if they don't have electricity, I can't tell you how many times I send money for electricity. And to this day, that house has no electricity. So they use the money for something else. And so, but yes, as soon as maybe you start, you settle down, you get comfortable, maybe you figure out how you can really properly make a budget, whether it's, okay, is it $20 I can just afford to send? Then you do that, and then you build from there until, you know, you can give exponentially. But yeah, I would say settle down first, figure it out, get all the insurances, put them in place, and then now start dividing that money. All right, final thoughts. I'm not going to ask the question. I'm just going to ask everybody to just say any final thoughts, what you think. I'll start with you, Dr. Musoma, because I know you're supposed to leave in the next 3 minutes. So give us your final thoughts first, and then we'll go around.
You know, everybody, we're so excited about capitalism and making money and all these false ideas of a man pulling himself up by his own bootstrap. We've bought into the Western lie, I call it. You know, that if you just work hard, then you crack the code. You know, the man who authored the book on the Wealth of Nations, John Quincy Adams, you know, he wrote The Wealth of Nations, which economics is based on. Before he wrote The Wealth of Nations, he wrote a book called A Theory of Moral Sentiments. And in that theory, he said, capitalism without benevolence will self-implode. And it looks like a lot of us are drinking that Kool-Aid. We think that there's a magic number out there that's going to bring joy, happiness, and all that. I think there's enough evidence. You know, I've got a lot of wealthy friends. They live in their big houses. They've achieved at the top of the level. And I'm hard-pressed to see joy. So for me, I'll take from my friend from Nigeria, Dr. Ohaji. Shout out to Dr. Ohaji. We do a foundation in Nigeria called Vroom Foundation. We do open-heart surgeries twice a year. And Dr. Haji once said to me, I was complaining to him about something to send back home. He said, man, we are privileged. If we never left, we'd be the same people asking. We are privileged. And so for me, I struggle. I'm not saying I'm comfortable or totally embrace it, but I don't want to lose the essence of Ubuntu, because this Western culture is depressing. Look at the number of people that are depressed, medicated, unhappy, and you tell me that equation is working for you. Yeah, you've got. So I'd say I'm going to remain benevolent to my country, to my people. You know, I'm not going to give because I want them to show receipts of progress. They're not an investment, they're my family. Yeah. And hopefully, and the last thing I'll share, and I'm going to go. When my father died 2 years ago, Mutsa, my daughter walked up to me and she said, Daddy, I'm so glad I have the African part of me. I said, why? Almost 30, 40 people showed up at my house, tired, off work, blah, blah, blah. But everybody cooked. They sacrificed. They didn't give out of abundance. And she said, because of that, I'm proud to be an African. We have to be careful what we give up in the name of this pursuit of happiness in America. Sure. So, I sign out. Enjoy your wealth and your individualism and your individualism.
No, before you go, no, we have to set the record straight. We have to set the record straight. So I pride myself in the same things. I like to give, and I feel like, you know, probably also having gone to medical school, I always say the biggest blessing that we all have is we can wake up, we see color, where our lungs are able to make negative pressure, push oxygen in and out. That's even the biggest blessing of all. And then I feel like we are blessed to bless others. I always tell my husband, you have two pairs of shoes. That means God has blessed you with two pairs. You can bless someone else with another pair. So I do believe, you know, I live by it, that I'm blessed to bless others. But then also, if I cannot even be a blessing to myself, if I cannot be good to me, how can I be good to you? The time will come. So for me now, I feel like if someone calls, you know, funerals at home, weddings, anything, everything, I take pride in providing. But also, I need to see a certain behavior, I guess. Yeah.
Priska, you've been quiet. What's your take on all this before Dr. Musoma leaves?
Before he leaves in St. Joe, no. I agree with everything that he said. Of course, I still believe in the spirit of Ubuntu. Of course, I help where I can. And of course, blessed is the hand that gives. And we are very blessed. If there was an eye-opening thing for me, is the last trip that I just came back from 3 weeks ago, how blessed we are and how much our dollar can go a long way. For instance, yesterday, Zoe and I had lunch. It was $37. I was even telling a friend of mine, I was like, this $37, we're going to eat Chick-fil-A. But then there's a family that can enjoy dinner for 2 days, like a whole family that it can feed. It's just that for me, I am asking, don't take advantage. Like Kola said, when I tell you that I don't have, I really don't have. Don't expect me to go and get a loan and go and get from somebody else to please you. So don't take advantage. Where we can give, we can give. Where we can assist, we can assist. And don't think that because I say I don't have, I just don't want to give you. That's a problem that I have. Other than that, yes, we give, we provide. We don't even need somebody to say, oh, this one gave and this one gave and this one gave. But yeah, for me, that's my take. Just don't take advantage. And if you say that I'm asking for money for me to pay for my school fees, go and pay for your school. Don't pay for something else. And then you come back and say, oh, I use it for this and I use it for that. There's an individual that it's like every single month I was going through my MoneyGram and I was like, this is every month, every week. It's like you're on payroll. Ask when it's necessary to ask. So I don't feel bad. Like, you know how many friends of mine that will be like, Priska, I can help. And I'm like, no, when I really, really need it, I will ask for help. But right now, I think I'm okay. So let's just practice that.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay, so I tend to be a little bit more direct. So I'm going to say some things, and I say this mm-hmm. from a place of love, and I don't mean to offend. But I think what's going on, in my view, is that, you know, nobody wants to be the bad guy. We always want to be liked, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that the approach over the last few minutes was an approach of possibly making somebody feel guilty or shame as a result of prioritizing themselves, right? And I know that's not necessarily the intent, but, you know, when we look at how things were said, that's kind of what I see from how it was said. So kind of go back to the main topic here. The main topic is it appropriate to be generous to people? Yes, it is. Nobody's going to deny that. At the same time, the question is, for our individual experiences, are you being generous or are you being taken advantage of? And I think that when we do that poll, a lot more people will say they're being taken advantage of rather than them being generous. If somebody came to me and said, hey, like that program that you guys have of saying we're doing open heart surgery for people, I think that's a wonderful program. Here's my $5, here's my $10, here's whatever to go do that and go from there, right? But the question I'm going to ask you, all of you individually, and it is a rhetorical question, is for the amount of money that you've given to your so-called friends and so-called family members, what is the return, right? Because the reality of the situation is that I think there should be a return. And what do I say by an example of a return could be, hey, you know what? I have my brother or my cousin over here. He's having trouble finding jobs or whatnot. I'm in podcasting. I need somebody to be an editor for my podcast. right? How about you just be the editor rather than me trying to do it myself or find somebody else to do it, and I'll just be paying you that money every single month. Every single time we've tried to do something like that, they would quote-unquote fumble. It will not work. They are not interested in doing those things, but they are interested in the money that you will give. I think generosity goes both ways. And I don't think that the folks back home, and I mean this with the most respect, not all of them like this, but some of them are not being generous in return. So I think this is a bigger conversation that we may need to have some more to kind of explore the nuances, right? If you show me the UNICEF video or the UNICEF photo with the eye, the fly going into the child's eye, right? You know, of course, nobody's going to argue that one, right? But when you're talking about other things, I think it's kind of key, right? There is no reason why we should not be able to collaborate on both sides of the ocean and be better together. There's no reason why all of you should not be able to have a virtual assistant in Africa that you guys are paying $100 to, $50 to, and the person is helping you guys to do things that you actually need help with, and you don't mind paying the money, even if it's painful to pay. Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of how I say it. Like, I don't see it. I'd have gotten to this stage recently in my life, right? I just give you some context, right? So I'm the first son in my family. I have sisters behind me. Some of that first son demands and mentality that you may associate with some countries in Africa is some of the things I've had to go through. And what I've come to realize is, hey, nobody cares about me. None of my family members ever ask me what's going on with me. They will ask me what's going on with me, but reality, what they are really saying is, let's get the pleasantry out of the way. They don't mean any disrespect. It's just how it is. Right? So I've gotten to a point in my life where I've said, no, I'm sorry. I'm prioritizing me. Because if I don't, you know, my folks are religious. I would die. They will all say, oh, it's the devil. It's the devil. It wasn't the devil. It was them. And they don't mean to be wicked. It's just the reality of the city. They're not wicked people. It was them. But it wasn't the devil. And because nobody ever calls it out as it is, I think. So I'll end there for now.
All right.
Zenith, I want to say one thing before we go. I'll say kudos. The 3 weeks ago, I was listening to a podcast. I don't know if any of you listen to it. It's called African Business. And these two gentlemen, you can look it up, African Business. They were talking about per year, people in the diaspora, just Africa alone, receives $95.8 billion from the diaspora. So I felt so proud. I think, no, $95.6 billion. I feel like I have a good amount in that $95.6 billion. Because just to Africa, this is not to Asia and all those other continents. Wow. Can you imagine how much we send back home?
No, we do, you know, it's a lot. It's a lot. And like we said, I think we're just scratching the surface. And I think I always say that there's so many things we can get into, you know, with just this black tax. And I hear what everybody's saying. And I see what you're saying, Paula, because I think I experienced it when I went home this last time. I went home and suddenly, like, I can't even find someone to stay with my son. Like, I'm like, where are all those girls?
That is true.
Like, now you're still paying for someone to stay home because they're going to get paid less. And you're like, oh, my God, I actually don't have anybody to even create time for me to say, oh, somebody's coming from the diaspora. They're coming here for 1 month. I'm going to take time off or be with you for 2 weeks. I was like, oh, my God, yeah, even just do you want carpenta or something, you know? So it's a little bit, it should be a two-way street. It should be, we also need something, right? It's not money, but we need something. We need help. We need to feel like we belong. We also need to feel loved. Even if it's a small chitambala, you just give me, I don't know, something, you know? And I thank you all for being here, Dr. Msoma. I know that you have to go, so I think we'll let you go. But thank you, Dr. Msoma, for joining us and your insight.
You're welcome.
We need to do another day of this topic so we can go deep, and like, I know there's so many nuances, like you said. All right. Okay, so everybody, we've come to the end. Anything you want to add on?
I once listened to a podcast. It was... the name of the podcast is called Everyday Spy. It's this Caucasian man that does the podcast. His name is Andrew, and he actually was, at a period of time in his life, he was a spy for the CIA. And in that particular episode I was listening to, he said that Africa is a place that money and resources go to die. And he has his own perspective based on his life experiences. I'm not necessarily going to go into that and say whether or not that is right or wrong. And we all know that Africa is not one thing. It's multiple things. There are a lot of positive things that we may not necessarily be focused on today, right now, on this. So I want to make sure we're having a balanced view. But the way that I look at it is, I'm looking at it for more of a bigger view. If I'm investing something into a business, because at the end of the day, this is fundamentally a business. You know, it's family members we're giving, but it's fundamentally a business. If I invested $95 billion into a business and I'm not getting any return, it's actually projected that I'm going to have to invest more money next year and the year after that and the year after that. At what point am I going to say this is not meaningful and I should change behavior? I don't have a problem with investing money, or when I say investing in this case, giving money to folks back home in Africa. But my hope is that the number will be reducing, not increasing.
Right.
Right. The reason why the money is increasing is because the needs are increasing. It could be inflation, it could be school, it could be whatever. It's increasing. But $95 billion is not trivial. Right. I don't know what the budget is for some of our countries, but I know it probably exceeds the budgets of a lot of countries in Africa. What's going on? I don't know the answer because I don't know.
Yeah. True. I have an uncle who has my dad's brother. He has a very big farm in Chongwe. And he told me, he said, my daughter, I have so much space here. And I tell whatever relatives can listen, if you want, you won't go hungry. You can come here, grow your cabbage, grow your whatever. But no one will do it. Because no one wants to do that work. No one will do it. No one will grow their food. But they'll be begging for money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's like we have, I don't know, we have, there's the whole Ubuntu and helping, but there's also where the line is blurred with dependency culture. The line gets gray somewhere and suddenly it's a dependency thing. Like someone can't even do something. They can't think of something for themselves. Like you said, they can't go to another town and look for that job. You know, everybody wants to be seen wearing a nice suit, smart, working in a bank, you know, that kind of stuff. And everybody's on Facebook in Zambia.
I agree. Absolutely agree with you. My sister has the same thing. She's got a farm, a very beautiful piece of land. I would love to live there. And she's like, everybody, I have given you this piece of land. You can even build your own house. You can eat from here. That helps us stop sending money from different avenues. Even if we're sending money, we're sending money to one direction. But then again, to touch on what Paula said, what are you giving back in return? What investment are we getting out of it? Yeah, it doesn't kill you to just be kind enough and say, you know what, somebody's coming. Like you said, Janet, here's a piece of chitenge, a wrapper. Here's a piece of something. We appreciate that. That way we don't feel taken advantage of. Mm-hmm. And another thing is think outside the box. You just don't have to work. You can create that employment for yourself. There's so much that you can do in Africa. You can sell water. You can start a barbershop. Just little things. You can even cook. You can go to the market. There is so much. But people don't want to think outside the box. People don't want to do just something extra. I cannot tell you how many times somebody said, oh, I went to the market, or I went somewhere, they were not there. Well, did you try to call? No, I didn't call. Why? I didn't think about it. Did you try to do this? It's just, let's think outside the box. Let's create that employment for ourselves if we cannot get employed. Oh, I'll stop here.
All right, people, this has been wonderful, and I know we can go for another couple hours getting into that, because yeah. I didn't even get to talk. Oh, well, actually, we did talk a little bit about the first trip back home, but I think it should be an episode. Well, lifestyle creep should be an episode for all of us, maybe in season 2 or season 3, just how we dealt with lifestyle creep and getting out of debt, you know, because that's another thing that affects us. And yeah, our first trip back home. And Kola, for you, it would be your second trip. But, you know, when you went back to Nigeria as an adult and what that was like. All right, folks, I thank you for coming here. This has been wonderful. And to all my listeners, until the next episode, it is goodbye and take care. Don't forget to rate and review, like, share, and subscribe to wherever you get your podcast from. All right. Goodbye. You can say goodbye, folks, and don't get off the
line. Goodbye. Thank you for having us.
It's Bye.
Thank you, Zenith, for the invite.
It's a pleasure. I always enjoy these conversations. So thank you guys for being so open and willing to actually talk about your perspectives. We don't have to agree, but just hearing about it and helps us educate each other about our different challenges and maybe come to some, some common way or some common goal of how we can collaborate in the future. So this is awesome. Thank you, Zenith, for making it happen. Truly African.
Yes.
Well, that was me, truly African. Okay.
I'm sorry, there's somebody from Zimbabwe. Mangwane.
Maneru Masquera say.
Did he write?
That's not bad.
Doctor, let me find out.
I went to school in Zimbabwe.
Oh yeah. Oh, where you said?
No, so I went to a little bit of I did A levels.
Where?
In Harare, right there by Spaces College.
Oh, Spaces! I was at Spaces College for my Cambridge exams too.
Yeah, but I only stayed like three months, then I left.
Yeah. That's a nice, very expensive college. Mugabe's son went to that college.
Absolutely. Yeah, of course.
Thank you for letting the rest of this population know, you know, how we roll. Mutsa looked up when she heard Harare. She just went like this. Hey, Mutsa, you want to hear what the people in Zimbabwe were so mean when I went to school there? You know what they used to say?
Why?
They used to say, why? Man, I went to Zambia. I was downtown. And I asked them, where's the capital? They said, you're standing right in it.
You know what?
Like, that's not...
Yeah, like it was such a blip, you know?
Yeah, even when I went to Zambia when I was somewhere in primary school, and I felt like, oh my God, this is it. We went to Lusaka, I'm like, this is it?
Yeah.
You know, when you compare Lusaka and Harare, it's very small. Like, I don't know, maybe you can... It's very small.
It's
small. That's it? They're done?
No,
it's very small.
In Harare, there's like Morendera, Borodale...
Yes.
Avondale and all those big boroughs that are really big. Wow. So.